The following is a message of the teaching ministry of Valley Bible Church in Billings, Montana. For more information, please visit our website at vbcmt.org.
Well, good morning. I am thankful that you're here. And, it's some people, when they saw a commentary on Deuteronomy, were thinking, you got to be kidding me. I told him I had a seminary student one time in seminary who was taking exegesis of Deuteronomy, and he told his wife about it, and she said, "What in the world are you taking that irrelevant book for a course?" Well, obviously he wanted to be there, and I was grateful, but I come to you as a cracked clay vessel, enabled by the Spirit to be and do more than I can be and do on my own. I understand that totally. The ground is level to the foot of the cross. Part of my identity is I'm a Christ follower, and probably number two in that is I'm a lover of Martha Ann, you know, my sweet wife and our kids, and just the blessing of having them in my life. So I'm grateful for Montana. I'm not a Montanan, but even more than that, I'm not a Californian. So just so you know, don't shoot me or put a knife in my tire or something. We're from Western New York, a little village of 950 people south of Buffalo, and grew up in a real basic household. And it just God saw fit to put his hand on me for ministry and took this cracked clay vessel, and it's progressively enabling me to honor his name, not because of me, but because of him. I did come to Christ at a young age, praise the Lord, and I told the guys last night I was not angelic or perfect. God was patient, and repented along the way with just bonehead things you choose to do, but thank the Lord for his goodness in using me to be here. I'm thankful for Pastor Joe's invitation to speak here at your church this week, and as he said, I care deeply for what God is doing in Montana, and like to see guys come this way and just be used by him. And I'm thankful for Christ followers like you that are lending your shoulder to the task, the plow of living and honoring God in a needy place and being a light in a dark world. I'm a local church guy, so local churches are huge to me, and thankful for what God's doing here. And God blesses me with students along the way. Joe and I connected kind of an Ethernet and an online kind of a two-way live class, and just thankful for others, Kurt and Rob and others, that Andrew, and who did I miss, anybody? Just thankful, because that enriches my life and helps me understand what God is doing in different places. All right, so my desire in these seven sessions, and I asked Pastor Joe, do you think they're up to seven sessions on Deuteronomy? I'm hoping you'll hang with me at least for some of them. I want you to better understand the message and the relevance of the book of Deuteronomy. It does have something for us. Now, you're going to see, and I'll develop this more tomorrow in Sunday school, but I do not at all believe that the Mosaic Law is binding upon us as Christ followers. So I'm not trying to, this is not to tell you all the ways you should be keeping the Mosaic Law. But I do think there are ways that the Mosaic Law and the Mosaic passages, like in Deuteronomy, reveal to us God's value system, what he wants us to pursue, and even ways to do that. So it has benefit for us to read it and understand it to be able to teach it well. So instead of being a black hole in your understanding of Old Testament, I hope that our time together helps you read it better, even teach it more effectively. So three of the sessions are going to be more sermonic. I have one this morning, Deuteronomy 4, one this afternoon, Deuteronomy 6, and then tomorrow morning service, Deuteronomy 10, probably my favorite chapter of the book. And so I want you to be able to see in those sermonic settings the ways that Deuteronomy can powerfully impact our thinking and our living. And then the other sessions are more instructive, if you will. Today we're going to do the kind of the big picture, the background to Deuteronomy. What do you need to know to interpret Deuteronomy well? Hopefully that I'm equipping you to be able to do that in various settings of life, whether it's teaching your kids or living it out yourself or teaching in church settings. And then the first session in the afternoon, we're going to look at the first four of the Ten Commandments. There is kind of sermonic, life-impacting stuff there, but I want to help you understand, not that I am in any way believing that we need to live. I'm not living out the Ten Commandments. Nine of them are re-enunciated in the New Testament, and so they have New Testament truth in them. But I want us to understand who God is and what he expected of his people in a way to understand his value system, because I want God's value system stamped in my heart and my life. And then we'll have tomorrow, Sunday school about the Christ follower and the law. What do we do with that? And then the last session tomorrow night would be like the climax of Deuteronomy in chapter 29, 30 primarily, that helps us understand even something relevant to our eschatology. So, big picture, you have a quote there in your notes. Everybody have your notes? So the PowerPoint I have is very selective, just for things that were image needy. And so you have the notes, and so I will, some are more selective than others. This one I'm probably going to do maps when we get to another section. Others I have more. So let me read this to you. Paul House, a guy who wrote Old Testament theology, he writes this. By any standard of comparison, Deuteronomy is one of the most important books in the canon. Its historical setting links the Sinai, Exodus 19:20 and on, and wilderness experiences through Numbers with the conquest of Canaan, Joshua, and provides a transition from Moses' leadership to Joshua's. It's a pretty big deal. It kind of brings together the threads of that first part of the Old Testament. This canonical placement concludes the Pentateuch by effectively interpreting Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. And yet it provides an interpretive framework for the former and latter prophets, the historical books and the prophetic books. Its theological emphases set the tone for how Israel must live in the land they will inherit from God who has chosen them. And I would say to live in the land in a way that puts God's surpassing character on display was God's agenda. How are they supposed to do that? It's exhortative, hortatory, you know, kind of sermonic. An instructional style offers rhetorical patterning for Old Testament historians, prophets, psalms, and sages. Now, every book in the Old Testament and the Bible is important, right? There are some books that are maybe tougher sledding than others. But if you know Deuteronomy, you're going to feel like you're at home in numerous other places. The history books, when they take the measuring rod of God's expectations, it sounds familiar because they're based on what God said through Moses and Deuteronomy in a more sermonic setting than Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. It isn't better than Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. The way it's presented is more usable by the historians to have that be their measuring rod. The prophets, when you read the prophets, and they talk about covenant curse, the threat of God's punishment because of the covenant treachery, it's like, I've heard this before. Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, and some other places. And the Psalms are just rich in their terminology and emphasis with truths that are in Deuteronomy. It just is, that's why I would see is that Deuteronomy and Isaiah are two of the mountain peaks as far as understanding God's plan for the world and who he is and what he does in the Old Testament. So back to the notes here. Beyond the Hebrew canon, beyond the Old Testament, Deuteronomy is with Genesis, Psalms, and Isaiah, one of the foremost quoted Old Testament books in the New Testament. Jesus himself uses passages from Deuteronomy to resist Satan's temptation in Matthew 4, 1-11. The four responses of Jesus to Satan's temptation are all from Deuteronomy. In fact, it's the book he quotes from most. The Psalms is the most quoted book in the New Testament. So the point is it has benefit. Unquestionably, this book, the capstone to the Pentateuch, deserves careful theological analysis. So you have those kind of weird little lines, and I'm going from bottom to top. So Genesis to Numbers, the first four books of the Old Testament, lead to Deuteronomy, which is the capstone of the previous books. The threads introduced in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers are kind of brought together. They're repeated, many of them, in Deuteronomy. The law, the Ten Commandments, are repeated in Deuteronomy, but there are some new things introduced. So it kind of is the capstone, the summation of the preceding books of the Pentateuch. And then from there, you notice the one area goes more up to the Old Testament historical books. And I've said Yahweh's covenant expectations presented in Deuteronomy provide the foundation for the yardstick by which he evaluates his chosen people in historical literature. And again, it isn't that Deuteronomy is better than the other books, but God revealed to Moses the book of Deuteronomy in a certain way to make it usable by later biblical writers to drive home the point of God's value system. And then the next long arrow going over to the prophetic books. The biblical prophets, major and minor, they call these the latter prophets in the Hebrew Old Testament kind of layout. The biblical prophets, major and minor, make use of the wording of God's promise of potential blessing as well as appropriate punishment in their messages to God's covenant people. The prophets are not creative guys. The prophets are Mosaic material guys. They're reminding them of something that God revealed to them with a very great clarity. God was never playing hide and seek with his people. He wasn't trying to cloak what he wanted and have them try to figure it out and smack him in the head if they don't. No, he wanted to clearly help them understand how they can live a life that displayed his surpassing character to each other and to the watching world, like he does for us. Praise God. We're not left in the dark. We have a God who cares enough to give us clear expectations, commands, prohibitions, and all of that to help us to know how to live a life that's a light in a dark world. So the prophets are drawing on Deuteronomic statements for both the blessings he made available to them as a nation and the covenant curses. Now, and then I have this little box. Many New Testament authors quote from the passages of in the book of Deuteronomy. Down the road here today, we're going to talk about some of the things you need to know to understand the Deuteronomy book well. And we have to remember there are some things that don't come across in a direct way. There are truths that are a part of God's value system for us that are great to listen to. And there are some aspects that are part of a covenant nation on land, promised land, at a certain point in time, that are anchored to that context. So we'll try to figure some of that out, trying to help you. And this is one of the things you want to know to understand any law passage. How do we find a normative principle? How do we find what comes across? So when I'm talking about the importance of these things, some of the things are important, and they stay there in their town, we'll see, the Old Testament town. But they help us understand God. And other things are foundational for what comes across that is backed up by the New Testament to help us grasp what he wants us to do today. All right, so first, the next major section, historical background. How did Israel get from Egypt to the brink of the promised land? Okay, So a key part of this background is in Genesis 12. This is the kind of the theological, biblical background. Genesis 12, verses 1 to 3. The Lord said to Abram, I use Yahweh a lot for that name for God, the Lord. So if I say Yahweh, it just is my translation does that. And it's for the same name with capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, right? So Yahweh is equal to Lord, all caps. The Lord or Yahweh said to Abram, go out from your land, your relatives, and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I'll make you into a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who treat you with contempt, and all the peoples of the earth will be blessed through you. So God has something big he intends to work accomplish through Abram. He's going to have a big collection of people that Exodus begins with, Israelites. But I want you to see here, he's going to make them into a great nation, and he's going to take them to a land, and in Genesis 17 and on, he talks about that land is going to be theirs. He's going to make them into a nation, he's going to give them a land found throughout the Pentateuch, throughout the prophets, throughout the biblical covenants, as part of the background that colors what God does here. Okay, so in the notes you have there, 1B, I'm going to this background stuff, and this would be the map. I'm going to explain that in just a minute. From Egypt up through the crossing of the Red Sea, from the end of the book of Genesis, where God's people are in Egypt, and God's providence, Joseph, and then the whole shooting match, Jacob and everybody came down to Egypt, and then they were there in the lap of luxury in the land of Goshen, and there arose a king over Egypt who didn't know Joseph and began oppressing them. And then after years and years, a couple centuries go by, they cry out to God for deliverance, and he sends them Moses to be his tool to bring his, God's, intentions to pass. Now, the Genesis 12 passage and Genesis 17, where the land is going to be yours, is the backdrop. We're going to read more about this in Deuteronomy 10 tomorrow. God had promised to make them into a people, a nation, and give them a land, to make them a blessing. And so he's going about bringing his promises to pass here when he does that. End of the book of Genesis. They show up in Egypt, early part of Exodus. We read about their change in circumstances. And then chapter 14 and 15, we have the departure across the Red Sea. So Exodus 5, 1 to 2, Yahweh raised up Moses to lead Israel and the people out of Egypt by means of the 10 plagues. And in Exodus 5, 1 to 2, I read here later, so Moses has come back to Egypt. He's given his excuses, and God said, get going. And he's coming to talk to Pharaoh, let my people go. So later, Moses and Aaron went in and said to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. Notice he uses that name, Yahweh, the Lord. Let my people go, so that they may hold a festival for me in the wilderness. This is the starting request. Door slammed shut. But Pharaoh responded, who is Yahweh that I should obey him by letting Israel go? I don't know anything about Yahweh, and besides, I will not let Israel go. Who is Yahweh? I mean, I've heard of this God and that God and the other God that allegedly have a role in my life that I care about. Yahweh's a nobody as far as I'm concerned. What is there about Yahweh that would compel me to let these slaves, a big part of my economy, to go someplace and maybe go further? No way. He's a nobody. Well, what does Exodus 6 and following have to do? Both of the 10 plagues, God introduces himself to the Pharaoh. He's just the all-powerful, amazing, controlling every realm of creation God. And all of his gods are pipsqueaks and allegedly have responsibility for this part of the world, of the created world. But guess what's demonstrated through the 10 plagues? He squashes them as a bug. Because he does what he does, it shows his domination of the area that's allegedly part of the control of the Egyptian gods. So he introduces himself to Pharaoh. Eventually, Pharaoh caves, lets him go. But who else is he introducing himself to in some ways? The Israelites. I mean, they'd heard of Yahweh before and God, and if they knew their history, they're aware of this God that was their God. But did they have a personal awareness that affected the way they lived? Well, some maybe, and others didn't. And so he wanted them to see, as he's about to take them through a fairly difficult set of circumstances, you know, being at the Red Sea and being chased by this whole massive Egyptian army, it looks like you're toast. Crossing the Red Sea, barren wilderness, a wrong turn meant certain death, all of that. He wanted them to know that he was not a promise big deliver nothing God. He was a promise big and deliver everything God. That he was worthy of their trust. He's worthy of their obedience and their love and their worship. So that's happening there in Exodus up through chapter 15, crossing the Red Sea. And so Yahweh, the God of Israel, and the one and only true God, introduces himself both to the Egyptian Pharaoh and clearly reveals to the Israelites he is the all-powerful God of the universe. This is not in your notes. I added this after. Who is sovereign over every realm of the created world. Now, I said in the heading here, 1B, from Egypt up through the crossing of the Red Sea. Now, I'm not going to debate this point. A map on the left, the very bottom part of the body of water, that's the northern tip of the Gulf of Suez. You have the Red Sea is this body of water around the Sinai Peninsula. And on the Egypt side, if you go think of it this way, the Egypt side is the Gulf of Suez. On the, between Sinai and the Arabian Peninsula side, it's the Gulf of Aqaba. So where in that whole area, so I don't have a map. The map, so there's the Gulf of Suez. Oops, sorry. And there's the Gulf of Aqaba, two sides of the Sinai Peninsula. So we're at the northern tip of that Gulf of Suez is what we see here on the left. And then you have, if you go further north, where the Suez Canal now exists, there was an old canal and an old depression, but you have Lake Timsa and the Bitter Lakes and the Bala Lakes there. And what I'm going to suggest, without getting in the arm wrestling match here, is I don't think the crossing took place at the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, there are friends and God-honoring people who think that's the case. Patterns of Evidence, a great ministry that has movies and things about the historical nature of biblical narrative, would say it's crossed. There's a video, a kind of a dumb video in some ways, because it has a lie in the middle of it. It's across this area of Gulf of Aqaba, and Mount Sinai is in the Arabian Peninsula. Again, that's an agree to disagree issue. I'm not going to have the arm wrestling match here. I could point you to resources. So what I'm saying is someplace, either the northern end of the Red Sea, or I would put it up in the Bitter Lakes or Lake Timsa area to the north of that. In the end, it doesn't matter, ultimately. What I want you to realize, crossing the Red Sea, wherever it was, but it has to match the itinerary that the Bible gives and the time it would take to go from point A to point B with, let's say, 2 to 3 million people marching along, had to be crossing a body of water that was otherwise uncrossable. It wasn't a mud puddle they could scamper across when the wind blew and they didn't get their feet very wet. No, it was uncrossable, except for divine intervention. So I mean, there is a debate out there, if you read and listen sometimes, and I would just say, I'm not at all interested in doing that here. I've written in places about that. But I do put it at the northern end or up at Lake Bala, Timsa, all of that, in that area. But it was an otherwise uncrossable body of water. So what God does in getting his people to where he's bringing his promises to pass is one of the most stupendous miracles of the Old Testament. This wall of water that wasn't just like in the Ten Commandments movie, maybe 100 feet across, it was probably 2 miles wide. Why? If you have 2 to 3 million people crossing a fairly good clip, it would take probably 12 hours to get them across. And if they were on a 100-foot wide deal, it's going to be like 5 days. So I just think, given the time frame, that we have this massive opening in the Red Sea. Walls of water on both sides. Dry land going across. So God brings him across this otherwise uncrossable body of water. It's one of the most stupendous and paradigm miracles of the Old Testament. Okay, the next part of the background. This is all just helps set the stage for the teaching that God gives and the lofty expectation God has for his people in the Mosaic Law. So letter to be. By the way, when you think about my outline points, I went back and forth on how to do this, and I wasn't able to make it consistent. When I have a number of outline points, when you do the Roman numeral 1, capital letter A, number 1, little a, 1 in parentheses, and I mean, you can get into really complicated and triple parentheses. It just gets, so I just do level A points, your first level, B points, your second level, C points, third level, and so on. And then 1, 2, 3 are parallel points. So 1A, first main level point, 2A, second main level point. Are you with me here? So 8 points by the letter of the alphabet. They're the levels of the outline. So if you want to know what was the last point, it was the last, whatever that letter was, point. And the number is just saying the first one, the second one, the third one, the fourth one. Some of you have furrowed brows. So I'm sorry. But so secondly, we have from the, so it was first one was from Egypt up through the crossing of the Red Sea, the end of the book of Genesis into the first 15 chapters of Exodus. To be from the far side of the Red Sea to Mount Sinai. So we're here on the we're at the Gulf of Suez arm. Remember, we have Sinai Peninsula between my arms. Gulf of Suez on the west side, Gulf of Aqaba on the east side, and there's the blue line. I'd followed down from the crossing up there by the Bitter Lakes Lake Timsa, and then coming down along the eastern shore of the Gulf of the Suez, because of some of the place names given in Exodus 1 to, I mean, from 14:15 all the way from, anyways, from Exodus early on down to Mount Sinai there at the southern end of the Sinai Peninsula. Now, again, it's just, it seems to be the best location. There are some other mountains in the area it could have been, but it's in that general location. So when you think about getting to Mount Sinai, it took them a few months to get there, and then they spent about a year or so at Mount Sinai. What happens at Mount Sinai? God gives them his law, the Ten Commandments. We'll talk about that a little bit this afternoon. He gives them all the law stuff after that, which includes the instructions on building the tabernacle. And so then, after he gives them the Ten Commandments and the following kind of exposition of the Ten Commandments and the other parts of the Mosaic Law, he has Israel build that mobile worship sanctuary, the tabernacle, that's going to be traveling with them as they travel the rest of the way to the land of promise. And so, a couple of things, and there's tons of things here, but a couple of things that are really, really important, and that is the Israelites up until this point had been a collection of ethnically related individuals. So I have Kurt up here. He's a friend and a former student with Vanessa and two other kids. They are an ethnically related collection of people, right? So some of you are too. So Israel was a group of ethnically, I mean, sense of family inheritance. Israel was all the descendants of Abraham. They were alive at that time. And by giving them the law, by the experience of the 10 plagues and the crossing of the Red Sea and providing for their food and drink all that way, they, and then giving them the law, their kind of their constitution, they were transformed from an ethnically gathered together group of people to a nation of his choosing. An identifiable, concrete nation with a ruler, a representative who ruled on Yahweh's behalf, Moses. So that transition takes place, and that's huge, because he said in Genesis 12, what was he going to do? He's going to make them into an ethnically related group of individuals, and that's it. Into a nation that would have an identity on earth for his glory. And eventually they're going to be in a land that's part of that identity. All right, so they transition from being a group of ethnically related individuals to a nation of his choosing. And this next truth is one of the most important truths, because it happens in a concrete way here, that Yahweh, the Lord, dwells in the midst of them, concretely. What happens after they build the tabernacle? I mean, he led them so far, and how did he lead them? Well, he had this pillar of fire by day and fire by night. That was, you remember when the Egyptian army's coming, and they have hills on both sides of them, and they have the army coming behind them, and it looks like they're toast. That pillar of cloud, imperceptible, they couldn't see through that, stopped the Egyptian army as God was revealing himself to Moses, and Moses put out his staff and they crossed the Red Sea for 10 to 12 hours as they crossed through this couple mile wide gap in the Red Sea. That was God in their midst, protecting them and guiding them. So for the rest of the way down to Mount Sinai, it wasn't that they knew every crook and cranny and every turn to take and where to get water, or if he didn't give it to them miraculously, but he brought them. And then when they built the tabernacle, and the tabernacle was a big 150-foot long tent, if you will, with curtains, and you had a rectangular building in the back part of it, smaller version, size-wise, and there was this front room that's called the Holy Place, and the back room called the Holy of Holies. In the Holy of Holies, there was something called the Ark of the Covenant that had some things inside it, but a mercy seat, some angels and their wings, and the Shekinah glory would come to rest above the Ark of the Covenant. And so one of the things they had to do in order to prepare for departure was they had to camp around that, the Levites and priests, in the first kind of circle or square, and then all the other 11 tribes of Israel around the rest. So they always had this camp, according to instruction, and there in the middle was who? Yahweh. Visibly present. Now, that wasn't all that Yahweh was. He was the God of omnipresence, right? But he manifested himself in visible form, in a visible form, to remind them that he cares enough to be with them. He's there to guide them. He's there before whom they offer their sacrifices. Living lives around that should have reminded them of their need to obey him from the inside out. He dwells in their midst. And then when the tabernacle's all done, it was God's time. There was a day that had to be a little bit shocking at first, but the Shekinah glory, the pillar of cloud by day and fire by night, was rising above. Whoa, 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 what's happening? It's taking off. It's rising above the tabernacle. And that was the signal, pack up. And it would motor off in the distance the way they're going to go, and they would follow it, and then it was time. It kind of stopped, and it'd lower some, and okay, set everything up. And he was not just the kind of biblical compass or something. He was their guide, their protector. He was the one who cared for their welfare and their destiny. He was their God. All right, so provided perfect guidance. He gave them a very clear visual evidence of his presence that should have motivated their heartfelt worship and their inside-out obedience. Now, sidelight, I mean, you and I as Christ followers who have been transformed by the gospel, we're his children, forgiven, bound for heaven, praise God. He dwells in us, Spirit of Christ. We're indwelt by the Holy Spirit. It's God who is in us. And you think about that, and I mean, that should help us too. I mean, it's kind of a scary thing. He sees everything and knows everything. But it should be a motivator. Lord, help me. I pray regularly. Lord, by your Spirit, I pray that you would help me to be and do more and better than I can be and do on my own. I want to obey him. I want to love Martha Ann well. I want to shepherd my kids well and to my grandkids. I long to do that. And then I have to seek forgiveness along the way. I'm not talking about moral impurity. My wife and I are pure and all of that. I'm just saying I'm a bonehead, right? I can be selfish. I can be impatient. And God knows, and my heart's heavy. So I seek forgiveness from the one I was impatient with and asked him to forgive me. So, I mean, the point is the same kind of life impact is ours too. It should be, as we think about him dwelling in our midst. All right, so then we have from Egypt to the crossing of the Red Sea, from crossing of the Red Sea down to Mount Sinai on the side of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Suez, and then we have third from Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea and the rebellion that happened there. So you see we're at the bottom left of this picture. All of these are from the Satellite Bible Atlas. I use it on my Israel trips, and so I just want to use the same source. The one on the crossing of the Red Sea is from the Moody Bible Atlas, and I have that in the PowerPoint. Now Mount Sinai is on the bottom left of this cropped map, and you come up because of the place names that are mentioned along the western side of the Gulf of Aqaba. They're traveling up, and then they cut over to Kadesh Barnea in the top in the middle left, kind of top middle side of the picture, Kadesh Barnea. And that was just where God was leading them. And yeah, they could have traveled due north into the land of promise, but Numbers 13 and 14 happened. They sent 12 spies in, one for each tribe, to check out the land, and came back and was like, wow, this is amazing. Fruitful and abundant and all of that. And God had said it was their land, and God had said he would bring them in the land. He'd give them victory. But 10 of the spies saw something else more prominently. The walls, they reached to heaven. There's no way we can conquer them. So, don't, we're not going to go. So the majority of the crowd said, no. We're not going to believe that God is going to be the God he's been already. We're not going to go. That's nothing less than rebellion. So the Lord said to them that every person who is 20 years and up, an adult in that generation, will never steal the land of promise. They tried to, okay, we're going to go and attack the land of Canaan. They got smashed. So for 38 years, really, what is, we say it says 40 years, but it was actually 30 years, but you round up 38, what is it? It's 40. So it's an approximate number, 40. They wandered in that area around Kadesh Barnea for almost 40 years, for 38 years, while that adult generation died off. Part of God's judgment on the rebellion, having seen who he was, experienced who he was, promised that he would bring them into the land, they blew all that off because they're focusing on horizontally challenging things, and they were punished. And so the point here is that he has something in mind he's going to do. And then we have 4B. We have from Kadesh Barnea, the top there, you can see Kadesh Barnea, and there's this little circle where God's people had wandered for those 38 years, probably from oasis to oasis to oasis. And then he says, okay, you can go on now. All that generation is gone. And so they're in the middle. You can go from the circle, and they go over here to the right. See, the Dead Sea is the body water on the top part of the map, and that's called the Arava, this kind of a valley, a dry valley, all the way down to Eilat, the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, at the very bottom of the map. Well, they make like a direct line from kind of Kadesh Barnea to the border of Edom, the shortest distance between two points. All people vote for that one normally when you're driving or whatever, right? Unless you want to take the scenic route. Anyway, longer story there. And they go to the Edom, I say, hey, can we come through? No. And God said, don't bother them. They're family through Esau. So you got to go the long way around. So then they go down according to the places. They had to go all the way down the Arava. It's about a 2.5-hour drive in a bus, a lot longer walk. Down to the Eilat or Etzion Gever and around to the top end of the Gulf of Aqaba, travel this route, the way of the wilderness, up at the edge of the Arabian Desert on the way up. And then for Edom, Moab, and Ammon, three relatives, Edom through Esau, Moab and Ammon through the sordid deal with Lot and his daughters. God had said, leave them alone. They're not for you to conquer. You're going to conquer Canaanites or Amorites. But God is the one who is orchestrating their travel. And what they're going to see here as they go to the Transjordan area is they're going to travel further north. And they're south of this is Moab. And then up north is, you have Edom they've passed through too. And then north and to the right is Ammon. So they're not attacking them, but in the south part, the Amorites had come in and taken land from the Moabites. And then up north, there are more Amorites who had taken land from the north of Ammonites. And God is going to give them victory over Sihon of Heshbon, just to the right of the Dead Sea, and from Bashan, or Og, of Bashan in the north. And the Lord is running the show. I mean, as far as big orchestration, he's bringing his will to pass. They come through Edom and Moab and Ammon. It was like, can we buy water and we'll leave you alone, nothing else. But they made the same request to these two guys, and they said no, and they gathered in battle and came against God's people, and God was setting up that circumstance because God hardened their heart like he'd hardened the heart of the Pharaoh, because he was going to enable the Israelites to defeat utterly the Amorites under Sihon of Heshbon and Og of Bashan. All right, I got to hurry up. So it was a foretaste of what God would do on the other side of the river. When they went against the Canaanites, and this is an organized city-state system, they might be like, oh, we're toast. There's no way. And what do you mean? He gave you victory over the Amalekites in the wilderness. He did the 10 plagues in Egypt. He brought you across the Red Sea. He'd done all of these things. He'd given you victory over Og of Bashan and Sihon of Heshbon. So it was to help them realize the God he was. He was worthy of their trust. And then 2.5 tribes got their allotments there. 6b, setting up their camp in the plain of Moab. So this is again, the plains of Moab is a wide spot. They were camped there for a number of months. And I can't pursue this other than read the passage, but the Moabites are south of here, and they were terrified what was going to happen. So Balak, the king of Moab, hired Balaam, the false prophet, to curse God's people, and they thought this would be magic. You know, these curses would happen like magic, and the Lord intervened and always turned Balaam's words to words of blessing. And maybe jot down Numbers 24:15-19. Numbers 24:15-19 is a messianic prediction that comes out of Balaam's mouth. That's part of what God orchestrated. So they're camped. God gives the book of Deuteronomy to Moses there when they're in the plains of Moab. And that's the next point, 7b. He preaches that book to his people. And then the Lord, according to his will, has told Moses he's not going to be able to go across because of his defiance of God's instruction when it came to the second time of getting water out of where there was just a rock. And he goes up to Mount Nebo, bottom kind of part where that white box is, and he sees uniquely the land of promise, and the Lord passes him into death, and nobody knows where he's buried. So that kind of leads up to Deuteronomy. I'm not going to ask if there are any questions, just I'm going to go on to some principles. And when Pastor Joe said we'll aim to be done by 10:15, that was not for your benefit, right? So I'm going to have to hurry here. All right, so basic interpretive principles, and I'm gonna gloss over a couple of these. One is context. It's always of great importance. Are you with me here? 3A, are you with me? Okay, this is one of those cases when you have to yes, no question, and a few people nod their head, and one or two say yes. It'd be nice if there was a chorus of yeses so I'd know you're with me. All right, so context is always of great importance. You have cultural context, customs, agricultural practices, geography, and so on that help us understand that world and where they're at and what that presents to a person traveling through the area. And also literary context is what we think of more often, and that is paragraph or pericope, chapter, section, book, corpus. So Old Testament, Pentateuch, this section of Deuteronomy, this chapter, this paragraph. So you don't want to take a verse and have a fit with it. You know, pull it out of the context and just do whatever you want with it. You want to make sure you understand the meaning of a verse in the passage, the section, the chapter, the book, the corpus, the Bible. So I would say that narrative literature in particular is badly treated because people don't do that. And they can go anywhere with a passage they think is significant and give meaning to it that is not really relevant to how the context develops it. There's more, we'll talk more about that in some of the expositions we do later on. The second was more of a grammar deal, and I'm going to skip over that for time, but that is, word studies are great, but word studies are dangerous. Don't just pick a word all by itself and then do something with it. Remember that word is part of an expression, a phrase, a clause. And we have to be careful we not just take a word and run with it. We want to understand that word's meaning and significance as it's with an infinitive or with a phrase or something else. So more to say there. 3b, the covenant triangle. And this is a backdrop for all of the Old Testament, but it just is, and this is something that originates with Dan Block, a senior scholar, a dear friend. But so you imagine Israel in their life, it's like they have before them and their understanding of life is a triangle where Yahweh is at the pinnacle of the triangle, and then you have the people of Israel in the bottom left and the promised land on the bottom right. And the issue is with Yahweh, God's people, as his chosen people, have a covenantal relationship with Yahweh based on Abrahamic and Mosaic and Davidic and New eventually. And so they have this covenant relationship, and we're going to come back to that, but keep in mind that word relationship. And then you have the promised land that they're going to go into here. They already started the first phase of that in the Transjordan area, and that's who owns the land. What God does. So divine ownership on the right side. And then the people of Israel's enjoyment of that promised land, what is it? It's a stewardship. It's not theirs for good. It's theirs as a responsibility. Why am I telling you that? Well, because along the way here, we have God talking about covenant curse or covenant blessing. In the Mosaic covenant in particular, in the context of being on the promised land, we have to remember that that's not something we're doing. That's not us. So there's some things that are anchored in the promised land or anchored in the Mosaic covenant that aren't to come across things. But to understand passages, though, imagine if there's on the left side of the triangle, the covenant relationship side of the triangle, let's say there's a grenade blows up and there's a disruption in that covenant relationship. What are the implications for Israel? Well, that stewardship part, that blows up too. They're evicted from the land of promise. So this was given to them to give them a land on which they could live their lives in a way to show each other and the world around them his surpassing character. And if they weren't willing to do that, and God was very, very patient, it took a long time to bring himself to do this ultimate covenant curse, they lose for a time the enjoyment of that stewardship. So that's a big thing in the background of Deuteronomy and even the Old Testament. And I talk about that there with some of this stuff. Maybe you can ask me a question at the end. Joe told me there's a trap door here that kind of opens up at 10:15, and I'd rather not have that happen. Either an alligator or something down there. And if they knew I'm in California, I'm even worse off. All right, so the issue here is that just is an arrangement where God's people, the Mosaic Covenant, have a national covenant between the people of Israel and Yahweh, and they also have this enjoyment of the land of promise, which is anchored and doesn't directly come across to us, but it helps us understand some of what God is doing. More to say there. Four, it is better to call the Mosaic covenant the Israelite covenant. Okay, who is the Abrahamic covenant made with? Abraham. Noahic covenant? Noah. Davidic covenant? Mosaic covenant? Not Moses. I try to set people up and have them. Oh, no, it's the Israelite covenant. It wasn't made with Moses. Moses was a conversation partner. He was the one, the mediator through whom it came, but it's a national covenant. And by the way, when I say that here, look at these two circles. Look at the left side, first of all, just exclusively. And that's why I call it the Israelite covenant, not the Mosaic covenant. And the thing is, there are some things that are true of life in Old Testament Israel that are kind of discouraging. Because you see, failure, 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 failure. You know, widespread disobedience, rebellion seems to be their penchant, their pattern of life. And here's the issue, is you have, in the Israelite covenant, it was, as an Israelite, you were part of the covenant. And it did not mean that you were a believer, a Israelite who had a faith relationship with Yahweh. So you had believing Israelites. There was always a remnant in Israel, praise God. But there's a whole host, probably the majority of the nation, were unbelieving Israelites. And so there are things that helps us with to realize that God is not okay with that, but he's paving the way. He's laying the foundation for his plan to come to fruition in the New Testament and beyond. But he's dealing with a nation because there are certain things he teaches us through that national perspective. But when we think about Deuteronomy, there are numerous passages where knowing it's addressing a nation and not just believers, it helps us not mishandle a passage. We'll talk about that later on in the book with chapter 28 and the curses and the blessings. But I'll just tell you that when you think about the Old Testament and the penchant of rebellion and covenant treachery and Israel's just boneheaded nature of not listening to who God is and what he wants from them, that isn't the end of the story. The darkness, if you will, of the Old Testament paves the way for the light of the New Covenant. And what's the biggest difference between the Old Covenant, the Israelite Covenant, and the New Covenant? Well, there's no inside circle. You know, everybody who's a believer is a part of the New Covenant. Everybody who is benefiting from the New Covenant as a believer. And that doesn't mean perfection. I mean, here at a church, we're all believers, right? So we'd all benefit from the New Covenant salvation that's mediated through that New Covenant. Christ ratified it through his death. Now, we still have boneheads. I'm one of them, right? I mean, we still have chances to sin, to disobey, to be impatient, to whatever. It isn't like we're perfect. But we have the Spirit who's given to us to help us live that life, hopefully more and more Christ-like each day. But in Israel, there were lost people who were part of the nation, a big part of the nation. There was like a millstone around the nation's neck ultimately, but it was a way for God to demonstrate his patience, even the appropriateness of judgment. There are things that are a part of that. So I just want to make sure you realize, number one, that the Mosaic covenant is better called an Israelite covenant because it's a national deal made with believers and unbelievers as God's people, his firstborn. The day is going to come, and I'd say at the end of the tribulation, millennial setting, for the millennium, that there's going to be all Israel saved, Romans 11:26. They'll look at him whom they have pierced, and God's going to restore a believing nation to the land of promise. That's another story, but 5b, understanding the national and covenantal focus helps us with a couple of things, and that is when I think about both the book of Deuteronomy and the biblical prophets, I would say to you that this covenantal focus, the Israelite covenant, Deuteronomy is a covenantal focus. book. Now, we might call it a law book, but we're missing the point. Yeah, the laws are specific stipulations, are chapters 12 to 26. They sound like Exodus and Leviticus a bit. But I want to emphasize to you that I think about it as a covenantal book. Well, what concept does covenant bring to mind? The word starts with an R. Relationship. Right? Some people talk and they get married. You're going to have a covenant marriage. The idea of it isn't like this burdensome headache requirements. It was the commitment of marriage. One man and one woman to each other. And so what I'd say, I put this in the notes, if you were to boil down the Israelite covenant in one statement, here's the statement: I will be your God and you will be my people. That's a relational core idea. Now, there are laws, requirements in the Israelite covenant, the Mosaic law inside of it. But I'd want you to realize that if you separate God's expectations from the relationship he was pursuing with them, you're going to misunderstand what those laws mean. The laws were never meant in the ultimate sense to be just a burden that could be done hypocritically and God be happy with it. They were meant to be part of a relationship. I've said this in other settings, but I would just say to you, when I think about various passages, Micah 6 is a classic one. I would say to people, God doesn't want us to live a law-focused life. He wants us to live a relationship-driven life with obedience to his requirements. It's the horses before the cart, not the cart before the horse. So in your own walk with the Lord, for you to be able to live a life for his glory, if you're just focused and fixated on the requirements, the to-do and the to-don'ts, smash your face in the ground. None of us are equipped for that on our own. I mean, it's hard enough with a sinful tendency, selfishness at our base of our nature, to live a life for God's glory. But on our own, you're toast. You're helpless. We need to be growing in our relationship with God and understanding of who he is. It sets our hearts on fire, and the overflow of that kind of a heart is obedience. Imperfect, yes. Needing forgiveness along the way. But that's how we live a life for his glory. And so law, requirements, are never meant to be understood apart from relationship. Okay, the most important part here is kind of 6b, the essential distinction between their town and our town. I'm not thinking of Sealy Lake and Billings. Okay, so this is especially important in Old Testament passages, as the farther away that are from our culture, true New Testament passages as well. So when you think about this image, and I'm borrowing this from Danny Hayes and Scott Duvall, you look on the left side. Are you with me all in the image? Okay, on the left side is their town. That's the Old Testament town. Flat roofs, people with robes, sheep grazing. I mean, it's an attempt to kind of help you think about an Old Testament town, right? So Old Testament, there's a context where all this takes place. And then notice on the right side, skyscrapers, you know, sloping roofs, people looks like pants, you know, a dress. I mean, in the old version of this, they're just stick figures, but it's our town. It's the modern world. And then you have, between the two, though, you have this river that flows through, and across it, the principalizing bridge. We're going to come back to this when we talk about the law tomorrow, as helping us think through what do we do with laws and how do we bring them across, the truths across, and what don't we do. And that is where you see in the river, you have culture, language, time, situation. Tomorrow we have a little box I inserted called covenant, Israelite covenant, as opposed to new covenant. I'd have nation, promised land. There are things where it helps us not bring across things that are meant to be in that context. But the ultimate issue is, and we're going to pursue this more tomorrow morning, if we don't understand an Old Testament law correctly in their town, in that context, we're going to do horrible things with it in our town. And one of the classic examples is, if I'm stepping on anybody's toes, I'm sorry, but I'm not. Pants on women. No pants on women is a rule. Right? And they go to the passage in Deuteronomy that it's an abomination for a woman to wear a man's clothing. It also says it's an abomination for a man to wear a woman's clothing, too. But what's the point there? Well, so they go across and they say you can't have pants because the Bible says it's an abomination for a woman to wear a man's clothing. Well, you know, what did the guys wear in the Old Testament in general? Robes. What did the ladies wear? Robes. Okay, maybe the robes were a little more colorful than the plain Jane ones of the guys, but it isn't about attire. It isn't about pants. It's probably a transgender kind of an issue that you embrace the gender God has given you, that there were people that were pursuing, shaking their fists in the hands of God in the Canaanite world. And point is, though, if you don't understand it correctly in their town, whatever you're going to bring across is going to be horrific. So we have to be careful. We understand the passage in its Old Testament setting. All right, and then some key contributions, the area of covenant relationship, that's 4a. Various things there, and I'll pursue some of that in the following presentations. 2, a theocentric focus, 2b, are you with me here? I kind of skipped down half a page below the image. 1b was the importance of covenant, 2b, a theocentric focus, are you with me? Okay. Is a theocentric focus, a God-centered focus, is absolutely essential for pursuing a life that advertises Yahweh's surpassing character to those near to us as well as those more distant. Now I'm going to come back to that. 3 very, very non-profound sounding words, upward, inward, outward. We have to start looking up. To live a life for God's glory, we need to be those who are growing in our understanding of who God is if we're going to live the life he's called us to live. So that's a huge truth that Deuteronomy presents in numerous passages. We're going to look at 2 of them later on. And then Yahweh's always been interested in internal realities, inside-out obedience and loyalty. If anybody ever says in the Old Testament God is okay with dotting the I's and the I's and crossing the T's, shout no! God has never wanted anything less than wholehearted, inside-out, genuine obedience. And then there's key things that we can misunderstand. Do Christ followers need to live in accordance with the Mosaic Law? Well, we're going to talk about that tomorrow. My answer is, I'm not under, when I'm thinking about how do I live my life today, and I go to the Old Testament, that statement, that legal statement is not law for me or you. Now, there's sometimes we can learn something about God's value system that could be helpful based on some normative principles we're going to talk about tomorrow. But a lot of challenges come to bear with bringing the law across as some authoritative deal that just comes straight across. Was the Mosaic covenant made with Moses? Try to pop that bubble. Israelite covenant, right? Everybody say with me, Israelite covenant. No. Okay, in general, was Moses or Yahweh thinking primarily of individuals with the covenant nation? Tried to deal with that one too. It's a national covenant. It's really important. We're going to see that's most important a little later on. This fourth one, ritual purity and moral purity. I wanted to get to this next one before the trapdoor hits me. You see, the thing is, in the Old Testament and into the New Testament, as part of the Mosaic or Israelite covenant world, you have things that were morally impure like today. Moral impurity is sin. But very uniquely, because you have a place of worship that up until a certain time had the Shekinah glory rising above the Holy of Holies, that and even when that was gone, they still practiced this. If you're worshiping in locational proximity to the visible presence of the Lord, you needed to become ritually pure as well. So ritual purity does not deal with things that are morally sinful. Here's an example. A number of you are married and have had or have kids in your home. We have 8, right? All of them are adults. Some of them are in our home. Some of them aren't. We have grandkids. When a woman gives birth to a child, she's ritually impure. But you can't worship at the temple tabernacle. What'd she do wrong? Is there something sinful about giving birth? No. Ritual impurity is generally, and I can't go down the road this very far, is given to help us understand kind of God's value system or what's important to him. And you have life, and life is in the blood. That life is important, and blood is, as it's part of the sacrificial system, is connoting the idea of the loss of life that is part of the foundation for forgiveness. So in giving birth, a woman, there's lost blood, right? Why is it? Again, I don't have these conversations every day in my life, but a girl baby who's born, the mom is impure for 2 months, and a male baby is for 1 month, because girls are a lot bigger headache than boys. No, that's not true at all. Not true at all. I have two daughters. I call them my roses in the midst of my six thorns. You know, we're the family with six boys, two girls, and we have six glorious granddaughters, three grandsons. Number four is coming. We just found out last night that they did a gender reveal. So the point is that girls are great, right? So that's not the issue. It's women with their time of the month, and all that involves blood. And so the issue is in the Old Testament, and there are other things we could talk about, a seminal emission for a man at night. If there's this automatic whatever semen emission, it's still, what is the semen connected to? The giving of life, the conception of a child. And God is trying to create this mindset that to worship me, you need to be ritually pure. Because you're worshiping in the locational proximity of my presence. And I want to drill down into your head life and all the things having to do with it is important. I can't go down this road, but you think about the whole issue with the woman with issue of blood for over a decade. That means for all that time, she was on the shelf. I mean, she couldn't even hang out with her family. She touched them, they'd be ritually impure. So the point is it's just as part of this deal, is part of the culture, helps us understand, but I want you to realize ritual purity is not moral impurity. Ritual impurity is not moral impurity. Okay, there's more things. I'm going to skip that last one, even though it's important. Questions? Kind of went too slow at first. Not the first time I've done that, I'm sorry. Questions? You know, when there are no questions, that could be a good thing. Yeah, I'm with you, I'm following. Or it could be, you're so confusing, I don't even know how to frame a question. It's not that one. Maybe it's somewhere in between. All right, I'm gonna let you do one more thing. Go ahead. I'm let's look at the end of the notes here. I just wanna do this one last thing. 5B. Because this could be a point of confusion in Deuteronomy in particular. What is the significance of the statements that connect Israel's obedience with everything going well for them? Do this, it'll go well with you. Do this, you'll live long in the land. Do this, you'll have all these great, tangible, concrete blessings. I mean, it sounds like cha-ching, cha-ching, like mercenary Christianity. Is that what the deal is? This is what I want to make sure I emphasize here. So, look at the bold. That it may go well with you, that you may live long on the land, and so on. Key point number one. What's the major overarching purpose for Yahweh's covenant people? And it goes back to Genesis 1, 26 to 27. Let us make mankind as our image bearer, according to our likeness. The overarching big function, purpose for his covenant people was put Yahweh's incomparable, surpassing character on display to each other and before the nations of the world around you. To each other and to the nations of the world around you. So that's the thing that should be job one for us. That should be the hunger and thirst, the passion for our lives. And all kinds of things are affected by that. So the purpose of obedience is put God's character on display, conduct according to God's clearly revealed expectations is the overarching purpose. Now, key point number two is this stuff in Deuteronomy. The enemy go well with you. You'll live long in the land. Key point number two, Yahweh's more limited purpose for his covenant people under the governance of the Israelite covenant and on the promised land. They may go well with you, live long in the land, all these tangible concrete blessings. This purpose is much more limited and short term than Yahweh's ultimate expectations for his chosen people in key one, point one. Live, put his character, surpassing character on display. So if I say here, if Yahweh's covenant people would be characterized by heartfelt, genuine, heartfelt obedience, he will pour out abundant, amazing covenant blessings on them, very concrete and tangible, including everything going well, abundance in every part of life, long life in the land of promise. But remember, it's subordinate, it's a limited, it's a on the promised land as part of the Israelite covenant purpose, which is not ours. So the result in that case, unlike above, the result is the purpose of obedience, put God's character on display. Here's the result of covenant obedience or disobedience, concrete covenant blessing or covenant judgment. And this is driven by conduct that's according to God's clearly revealed expectations, covenant obedience or disobedience. So what I want you to realize is in Deuteronomy, all that language about cha-ching, cha-ching sounds like, it is not mercenary Christianity. It is very limited, on promised land, part of the Israelite covenant period of time, when God has given them this unique promised land on which they should live their lives in a way that honors his name. And if they are characterized by covenant rebellion and treachery, God's going to take that away. And so blessing is very concrete. Cursing is very concrete and at a national level. Otherwise, Deuteronomy 28 and some other passages are used horribly in the health and wealth gospel, misunderstanding this important truth. All right.